There will always be a special place in my heart for the movie musical and for the songs that create their most memorable moments. Here to perform the Oscar-nominated, gorgeously empowering song, Let It Go, from the Oscar-winning animated movie Frozen, please welcome the wickedly talented, one and only Adele Dazeem.
I want pizza tips.
All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome! Welcome, one and all, to episode 65 of the SLS Cast. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are now at the Enterprise episode of the SLS Cast. And not just any Enterprise, ladies and gentlemen, but the USS Enterprise. And once again, not just any USS Enterprise, but the U.S. Navy's first nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, the USS Enterprise. And why? Because the hull number of the USS Enterprise was 65. Specifically, CVN-65. But hell, when are you going to talk about the first nuclear-powered aircraft carrier? Never. You're never. And on that wonderful historic note, I am your Travoltified host, Miren Whaleson.
And I am your other Travoltified host, Tom Keezy, or Tommy Keezy.
Gotta love that. Go John Travolta.
Oh, wow.
So happy that he was out there in one of the absolute all-time worst toupees ever to introduce Adele Dazeem. She's phenomenal, by the way. You know, she looks and sounds exactly like Idina Menzel. I don't know how she does it. Maybe they just couldn't afford Idina Menzel. I don't know.
Yeah, and that was definitely one of the many highlights of the show. But did you get to watch any of it other than like YouTube clips or anything?
Honestly, no, I did not. I was unfortunately out of town over the last few days and running around like a chicken with my head cut off, being prepared to get out of town. Due to a death in the family. My uncle passed away, my favorite uncle. So he got the full military honors and everything, so it was really cool to see the 21-gun salute and all of the actual pomp and circumstance that is part of a full military honor burial. That was really, really cool to see. You know, just got to celebrate his life. That's how we like to do things. It's more of a celebration of life instead of a sadness and death kind of thing.
Yeah.
At least as much as we can do. Of course you're still sad.
Right. Well, that's good though. So did you get to see the pizza guy, the pizza delivery, or hear about the pizza delivery in the middle of the Academy Awards?
I heard about that and just briefly garnered the fact that some pizza delivery guy ended up on stage or something at the Academy Awards and ended up getting tipped like $1,000.
Yeah. What's great is that he had no idea he was doing that either. I mean, it was like a...
There's no way he had no idea he was about to walk onto a live telecast. See, this is the thing that I'm like, with the whole Bud Light thing, right? Back at the Super Bowl.
Oh, wait. You mentioned Bud Light. Let me... Just so happens, I actually have a Bud Light in hand.
Outstanding. But seriously, the Bud Light thing at the Super Bowl, that ad was all, this is not an actor. And it's like, bullshit, this guy's not an actor. But they did kind of explain it away.
Yeah.
That they had narrowed it down by putting a fake personal ad on like eHarmony or something like that. And based on the responses that the guys gave, and of course had to give a photograph, they were able to narrow it down to get to choose that guy. But, I mean, in this particular instance, there's so many clearances you have to sign and things you have to release to have your image out there and all that kind of stuff. There's no way he didn't know what was coming.
Well, according to the producers, they ordered the pizzas on Saturday, and they already had, like, ovens and shit in the wings ready for it for the actual Academy Awards ceremony. But the guy, they only told the pizza place that they were wanting the pizzas and it was for the crew and the people backstage. So the delivery driver, of course, you know, he knew he was going to the Academy Awards, but he only thought it was only for the backstage crew.
So first of all, when we had this idea of getting pizza for everybody, and we were trying to find something close by, and the place that you actually, your family owns the place, right?
Me and my brother.
You own the place.
Yeah.
All right. And so we had you deliver, and you thought you were going to bring them to some producers. What did they tell you?
Yeah, they told me I'm going to just deliver for writers. Mm-hmm. And then when I was there, they just told me, just wait here. And you came out then.
Yeah.
You came out and you said, just follow me. I'm going to let you know when to follow me. And then, like, where we are going. And you said, just follow me. And I'm going and I'm on a stage. I was just shocked. So
that was great. Yeah, this is, we had you behind a door, and then you just got out and said, you go, hello, here's, I mean, that must have, like, freaked you out, right?
Yeah, I was shocked. I didn't know it's going to be something this, but yeah. It was really crazy.
So you left before I wanted to get a tip, and I passed Pharrell's hat around, and I ended up getting about $600, something like that. Here's some more. There's $1,000, so you have a total of $1,000 tip.
I guess that's pretty exciting.
Sure. Either way, more power to them. I think it's fun when they can do that kind of stuff. It's just, yeah.
I want pizza tips.
But the only other thing, though, that was interesting that I found lately was something that I stumbled across yesterday, actually. and I just wanted to put this out there because I think this is about the funniest thing that I have heard in a long time. This was from Delish.com, actually, courtesy of a Kiri Tenenbaum. And this is a guy who decides to sue McDonald's for $1.5 million. Now, Tim, obviously we do some form or fashion of show prep, so you already know. But when you first saw this, what did you think? What could you possibly be thinking about a guy wanting to sue for $1.5 million? What would you think would cause such a kerfuffle?
Coffee. Why not? It seems like yearly or even weekly McDonald's gets sued for scalding hot coffee.
There you go. This particular gentleman decided that he did not receive enough napkins.
Oh, and, man. Wow.
Yeah, he got a paltry one napkin when visiting his Pacoima, California McDonald's, his local.
What did he
McDonald's
order?
There.
Like a taquito? A taquito?
Who knows? Who knows? They don't say what he ordered.
I mean, most of the items there don't even warrant a napkin.
I'm telling you. But then he said that he ordered. Or he, not ordered, but he asked for more. And then he was denied. Now, this is the poor man in question is a gentleman by the name of Webster Lucas.
Oh.
And he subsequently told the manager on duty, quote, "I should have went to eat at the Jack in the Box because I didn't come here to argue over napkins. I came here to eat," end quote. Now, to respond to this, it says here in the article that according to Lucas, who is African-American, the manager then made a racially motivated remark, allegedly saying something about you people. Parenthetically, it says that the manager is reportedly Latino. Now, pause it here. I would like to theorize and postulate, if I may, that the you people in this regard was not a euphemism of race, but perhaps a euphemism of the group of people who have nothing better to do than bitch about the quantity and or quality of napkins at McDonald's. That's just me. I could be wrong. However, unfortunately for all involved, apparently, after the verbal disagreement, Lucas emailed the general manager of the McDonald's to say that Napkingate caused him, quote, "mental anguish," end quote, which has prevented him from working. The general manager offered Lucas free burgers, but Lucas instead decided to sue McDonald's for $1.5 million. Now, you see what the critical error in judgment of the general manager was, don't you? Can you see what he did wrong?
Offer him free shit? Back down? No. Backing down from smacking
no,
him across
no, no,
the
no.
face?
It wasn't to offer him... See, he offered him free burgers, when in fact, he should have offered him napkins. He should have said, buddy, you get your butt down here. I will give you a case of napkins. I'll give you a case of napkins, and anytime you come back in here, I will give you a case of napkins. And that is what should have transpired. But no, see, they didn't do that. They remained firm on no more napkins and instead offered free burgers, which just, I imagine, must have completely magnified the problem because he would be thinking to himself, but I won't have any more napkins for my free burgers. Whatever will I do?
Wow. This is the reason why nerds get the rap of, you know, getting bullied and getting, like, atomic wedgies. Jeez. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, Wilbur.
At any rate, I get, that's my fun thing there. It was just so completely outlandish, I thought you would get a kick out of it.
What could be next? Somebody suing because the burgers aren't as advertised?
Well, I think Michael Douglas tried that in Falling Down, but it didn't really gain any traction. Robert Duvall killed him.
Right.
At any rate. All right, well, shall we go ahead and jump into the news then?
Yes, let's do it.
Then here it is, folks. The news! The news. Okay, I'm going to go ahead first here because I've got some fast stuff here I think I can get through.
Sure.
Well, at least my first one's pretty fast. From Variety.com, courtesy of Justin Kroll. After a final rewrite to the script and a long casting process, Fox looks to have assembled the team for its Fantastic Four reboot. Yes, Miles Teller, Kate Mara, and Jamie Bell will join Michael B. Jordan in the latest installment in the comic book franchise. Woo! Exciting, don't you think, sir?
Honestly, no. I mean, to me,
I know it's
not...
really not, but I thought people might care. There's got to be some people who care about this thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I don't know with this and the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff, you know, which is, I mean, I guess it's cool, but it's I'm just kind of, I'm marveled out, man. I am way marveled. I mean, it's,
I understand.
Bring me a collection of like a superhero-esque movies of Steven Spielberg films or Stanley Kubrick movies, and, you know, you might have something there. Assemble a team of Jurassic Park dinosaurs, E.T., Indiana Jones, what else? Abraham Lincoln? There you go. Abraham Lincoln T-Rex Slayer. I think that would be a massive hit that I would be down for. More so than Fantastic Four, but, you know, I don't know. I think that's one of those things to where it's like, are you sure they haven't waited long enough? Or maybe they're just really itching to jump on the boat with the whole Avengers thing. And also now that they know the Justice League is going to be sprouting out soon into their own movies.
I don't know. This one, the Fantastic Four thing really isn't doing anything for me, but it is news. I thought that perhaps maybe there might be people out there who wanted to know at least if there was a Fantastic Four reboot happening. Because this one's been pretty quiet for the most part.
Yeah. It might be good.
There you go. Indeed. What do you got for us, sir? What's your first
time? Okay, so Veronica Mars, the movie based on the cult classic... Well, I mean, I don't know if it was necessarily a cult classic TV show. I guess a more modern cult classic, kind of like Serenity in a way. A TV show that didn't last too long. I think only just a couple seasons, I think. The movie version is coming out here in the next month. However, studios... And this is the movie that is only made due to its Kickstarter campaign, which started, I think, maybe a year ago. So, I mean, they're already made the movie and releasing it just a little over a year since they actually started the Kickstarter. But the studios are doing something interesting. And it's been done before. I mean, it's nothing really new. They're releasing it in the movie theater, And March 14th is when it's supposed to be released, as well as on video on demand. And for those of you that don't know, Veronica Mars is the Kristen Bell character. It's like a noir in a way. She plays a detective. That's pretty much all I know about it. But the Kickstarter campaign raised $5.7 million to finance the movie, and it's set like 10 years after the events of the series. So what do you think, Matt? So it's going to be open onto like roughly 270 theaters across the country, as well as video on demand. Is that like a wise decision due to it being based off a cult show and not like a widely accepted TV show or property for that matter?
Sure. I would venture that, yeah, mainly because the movie was made of primarily Kickstarter money.
Right.
So they don't have to pay anybody back. Anybody who gets producer credit on this thing is going to be strictly the people involved directly with the movie, and they're going to make all the money. The VOD is going to be great because they don't have to have... They clearly only had to have enough extra funds for distribution to the theaters, but anything they get through VOD is going to support what they didn't spend on advertising, because this has all been done via Kickstarter and everything. So, sure, why not? I think this is good. It's not 20,000 screens. It's not 10 screens. I think it's a pretty moderate number. I'm sure they've kind of gone to where the heart of their fan bases are to give it the widest possible release for movies that way. But, I'm pretty sure they know what they're doing on that score. I mean, I'm not going to go see it, but then again, I didn't watch the show.
Yeah, and it turns out that Warner Brothers, who's distributing the movie, according to the HollywoodReporter.com, that Warner's, quote, actually rented out the locations that this movie will be released in, and most are AMC theaters. So if you're an AMC theater fan, there you go.
Okay, well, this is something that I wanted to get to last week, but there just wasn't time. Vulture.com did a wonderful piece on Alec Baldwin, and the piece is kind of weird. It was kind of done by proxy, more or less. This is called Alec Baldwin: Goodbye Public Life by Alec Baldwin, yet as told to Joe Hagan. So this is going to be a co-courtesy of, because this is courtesy of Alec Baldwin, apparently via Joe Hagan. This is ostensibly a op-ed that is explaining where Alec Baldwin is in his life, personally and professionally, and where he thinks that things have kind of gone wrong, both personally and professionally, that has led to his decision to retire. He's going to step out of the limelight for apparently the foreseeable future, and quite possibly forever. He wants to spend time with his youngest child and his wife that he has been married to for a few years now, that he is very excited about. It's a really interesting read. I was actually directed to this article via a link to Breitbart.com, which is like a conservative thing, and I just the link caught my eye because the link was misleading. So I was like, okay, what the heck are you guys sourcing? So I went, I looked at this thing, and then I went to this actual article at Vulture. And if you see it from anywhere else, don't worry about it. Just go to the Vulture article, and you will be fine. It's a really cool article. I would definitely recommend you read it. It's quite lengthy, but it does go into his trials and tribulations with the press overall, with the whole, I guess, faggot debacle that had occurred. The stuff with TMZ, things with Fox and Breitbart, as well as MSNBC. This is not a mea culpa in any way, stretch, or form. It's really more like a, guys, this is my side of the story. Why don't you take a listen to what I have to say, and in a format and in a venue that allows for him to actually fully express himself. And you know what? I gotta say, I totally see this guy in a different light. Now, am I his biggest fan? No. But it's just because he's a regular guy in a bubble. And sometimes, it's not so much fun to be in a bubble. And I would definitely recommend you read this. I really came away with a whole new appreciation for Alec Baldwin as a person. And if nothing else, you get to read through the whole article, and it closes on the quote that I gave at the end of the show last week. So there's that.
Okay, so I have a couple movie adaptions to somewhat announce, unless, of course, you people have... Well, I guess I shouldn't say you people. You guys, you listener, have heard about this already. One of them is a movie, or actually a Broadway show based on a movie based on a computer game, and a movie based on a classic TV show, a classic children's TV show. All right, the first one, based off a computer game, is Minecraft. I think they're taking a page out of the Lego movie to create a movie about people, or I guess they're people, living in a computer 3D world where they're just blocks and messing with blocks and just doing block-like things. Or I guess, not blocks, but I guess cubes. I mean, they live in a cube-like environment. You live and die and you fight various things, I guess, depending on whatever level you're on. But I know that it is a very popular game. And of course, they will most definitely make a movie based on it. All right, so the Broadway show, there's a Broadway show coming out. And it's based on a little Robert Zemeckis movie called Back to the Future. And it turns out that they're going to do this and premiere it in London next year sometime, around 2015, but there's no set date yet for a Broadway release. Robert Zemeckis, the director, screenwriter Bob Gale, as well as the theater director Jamie Lloyd, who have kind of developed the making of, you know, wanting to do Back to the Future, are all tapped to create it. You also have Alan Silvestri, Glenn Ballard, who's going to be doing some of the additional music and lyrics. You also have the Huey Lewis in the News song, Chuck Berry, and Curtis Williams songs, and all that, you know, that Power of Love, Johnny Be Good, etc. Those will also be featured in this show. So that should be something interesting. And I gotta say that I think my dad predicted this, because I remember being, I don't know, maybe 15 or 16 years old, whenever I was doing theater, I was going to see a lot of shows. And I got my dad into going downtown and seeing a ton of shows. And he came up to me one day and said, Tim, you know what would be interesting? Actually, I want you to create this. I think there should be a Back to the Future show for the stage. Some kind of a musical or something like that. And I told him, it's like, yeah, you know, it'd be interesting, but I totally don't see that happening with the car and all that. So, you know, you just have to have the car just going from one side of the stage to the other, and that's it. Special effects and... You know, and I thought, you know, there's no way in hell that Robert Zemeckis, Spielberg, and Universal will ever resort to adapting Back to the Future to a stage show. Well, it turns out I was wrong, and my dad was right. And, look, we're going to have a Back to the Future musical. Disney, it turns out, is revving up, according to the Hollywood Reporter, for a live-action feature of the Chippendales. Or just Chippendale, and it turns out that a gentleman by the name of Robert Rugen, he's a director, was the one that pitched the movie. Disney decided to, you know, hop on board and go along with it. However, Robert Rugen, what is interesting here, he is known for directing commercials. He's a commercial director. His most famous commercial is a Durex condom commercial, where it's various animals made out of condoms basically screwing each other. So it's very interesting that Disney will associate themselves... Well, actually, I guess it's not interesting, but yeah, I guess I just find that interesting. So yeah.
From the independent.ie, courtesy of the Press Association, Rogan to make Console Wars film. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg are to make a movie about the 90s battle between Sega and Nintendo. The pair will pen the movie based on Blake Harris's book Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation, which documents the corporate battle that helped turn video games into a massive industry. Turns out that Sony optioned the movie rights to Console Wars, despite the fact that the book won't be released until later this year. Yeah.
Very cool. I think that'd be pretty interesting. At first, for some reason, I thought it wasn't about, like, the video game consoles. For some reason, I thought it was about Blu-ray and VHD, you know, home release wars. You know, they had the Blu-ray player and they had the HD player. And I know there was, like, a big battle between that. That might be the sequel. Who knows? I can see them creating a sequel and having it be that for some reason. Unless if it was factual, then, you know, probably not. Okay. Well, The Hollywood Reporter, leading on up to the Academy Awards this past week, weekend, I should say, they started releasing a series of articles called Brutally Honest Oscar Ballots. And I think they had like 7 or 8 of them, and this people, or I might have been just the same person, would interview various voters of the Academy Awards. They would ask them who they chose, which categories that they're eligible to, you know, vote on or vote for or whatever, and who they picked and why they picked it. Again, there's like 7 or 8 of them, but I chose a few key little quotes here, or just snippets from these that I think you might find interesting. If not, maybe it'll shed a little bit of light on why some movies are nominated over others and why some movies actually win over others. One thing here, this is an observation that I had, is that a lot of these people didn't see movies. Some of these voters actually admitted to walking out of The Wolf of Wall Street, for example, because they just didn't agree with the, I guess, thematic elements that are within the movie, the sexism, especially if it was a female voter, they just got up and left. And to me, I don't know, I think that kind of, it's not a fair representation of voting for a movie if you don't actually sit there and watch the whole movie. Because sometimes with movies that can be perceived as being very violent or being very raunchy or being very over the top, sometimes at the very end, it brings the whole experience together so you actually understand what the movie is about. But, you know, regardless, I'll move on. Here's an interesting quote from a voter. Quote, "Didn't like The Broken Circle Breakdown because movies with actual child endangerment are upsetting," end quote. Another voter admitted to voting for Happy, the song Happy, for Despicable Me, because it's just a happy song while Let It Go is just too obvious of a song. I thought that one was pretty interesting. A senior citizen voter here said that they chose not to see 12 Years a Slave because she, quote, "doesn't want more terrible stuff to keep in her head. I've never liked movies that have severe violence," which I thought was very interesting. Again, another one. They didn't want to see 12 Years a Slave because of the content, despite its historical storytelling. Another voter liked 20 Feet from Stardom because it was well-publicized. Another voter here, quote, "I like The Great Beauty a lot, but a lot of my friends who were voters walked out because they felt that it was too boring," end quote. And in reference to the Best Director category, one voter said that, quote, "I don't understand how the Best Picture could not also receive the Best Director Academy Award." And in reference to the foreign language film, another voter said that this was the worst selection of foreign language film nominees for the category in years, which I thought that was interesting. And last, you know, a couple more here. One voter said that he didn't like Bruce Dern in Nebraska. Again, he was nominated for Best Actor because he was just standing around with his mouth open. And then finally, a voter didn't care for Amy Adams at all. Didn't see why she was nominated for Best Actress because her breasts distracted him during the movie. He couldn't really, you know, get into the movie because her boobs were always somewhat visible throughout the movie. So yeah, I just wanted to share a few of those, and yeah. What do you think, Matt? Is that something that's still like just obvious to you that people think this way, or does it kind of surprise you at all?
The sad part is that it does nothing but a disservice to those who think that the Academy Awards is nothing but a big circle jerk anyway, and now they have potent ammunition with which to fire their venomous bullets going forward.
Their venomous bullets, I like that.
Thank you. Coming to us from Cinnamon... Cinnamon? What the shit? Wow. Okay. Coming to us from CinemaBlend.com, courtesy of Eric Eisenberg, Vin Diesel has been a perfectionist behind the scenes of Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, he actually plays Groot, which is a treant, if you will, for those who are into that kind of vernacular. For those who are not, he plays a dude that's like a living tree kind of. A tree alien. Now, the thing is that in the comics, Groot is intelligent, yet he only says, "I am Groot." And the thing is that that's more or less what they're intimating, that he's the only thing that he's going to say is, "I am Groot." Yet, according to Gunn, James Gunn, the director, he says, quote, "He's a perfectionist. He made me explain to him with every 'I am Groot' exactly what he was saying. Then Vin would sit there and he would do it, and he would do it again and again and again, and his voice is so rich and so beautiful, and he really opened up and was this character. It was amazing when we first put that voice in there how much the character changed and how much he influenced the character," end quote. This is basically just trying to say that Vin Diesel has a talent for really trying to get at the heart of a character, even if it's only for one line. Something that was actually brought up about him for Iron Giant, because he used the voice of the Iron Giant, which anyone who has seen that film knows that he says approximately 4.5 words for the whole movie, but he does like make noises and grunts and stuff like that. So I thought that was kind of cool that he's really dedicated, and it does go to show that regardless of what you think of his acting ability, that he is committed and he does actually care and try for his roles. I thought that was at least nice of them to do. What about you, Tim? Does that warm the cockles of your heart?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's nice. I guess it's something to look forward to, Vin Diesel going back to his Iron Giant roots. Because, in fact, that might have honestly been like the last movie of his that I absolutely, unconditionally, like, just love. So, who knows? Maybe that's a sign that I will, in fact, really enjoy Guardians of the Galaxy.
Sweet!
Obviously, the Academy Awards this past weekend, and unfortunately, I think they kind of overshadowed, I mean, I would think, the equally prestigious Razzie Awards. The winners of this year's Razzie Awards, I'm gonna go through, and again, these are for, like, the worst movie, worst writing. It's just, like, the best of the worst of Hollywood films this past year. Just a few here. Let's see. Worst Screenplay, Movie 43, written by 19 screenwriters. Worst Director, the 13 people who directed Movie 43. Worst Prequel, Remake, Ripoff, or Sequel, The Lone Ranger. Worst Screen Combo, Jaden Smith and Will Smith from After Earth. Worst Supporting Actress, Kim Kardashian in Tyler Perry's Temptation. Worst Supporting Actor, Will Smith, After Earth. Worst Actress, Tyler Perry in drag for A Medea Christmas. Worst Actor, Jaden Smith in After Earth. And finally, the big kahuna here, Worst Picture is Movie 43, which that doesn't surprise me at all. I'm glad that we didn't actually cover all three of these movies that have been nominated for the Razzie Awards.
Cover one of them.
Well, we covered two of them. We did After Earth and Movie 43.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
One of them was at my suggestion, the other was at your suggestion. Let's try to do that again this year, where we only watch one bad movie that is so bad it gets nominated for the Worst Picture Razzie.
I'm sure it'll happen. I am...
It might happen very soon.
Yes.
All right, let's see here. For me, I've got a wonderful article from Crack.com, courtesy of Derek James, and these are 6 insane fan theories that actually make great movies better. And I'm not going to go in all the details and everything. I am going to go over the theories themselves real quick. And one of them, number 6, is that James Bond is not a man but a codename. And this is one of the things that I was very upset with Skyfall about. This is one of the things that I felt hurt it, was because they really tried to destroy that mythos that let you insert new actors into the franchise and carry it forward for 25 movies and 50 years, was that James Bond, 007, was the code name given to the man who filled the role. And then you could continue to have fun and expand the role and change it whenever they had new people come in. You were good. That was kind of... So that's something that actually is now being purported. Number 5, that Zion is part of the Matrix. And so imagine, if you will, that the Matrix, which is what everybody's plugged into, and then, of course, you unplug from the Matrix, and then you're out there. But that's just another set of the Matrix. And that was something that my father-in-law and I discussed for literally, like, 3 hours one day. Because I was like, nah, man, I'm telling you, he's got to be in it. He's got all these magic powers. So that was kind of cool. Number 4. This was a new one for me. Ferris Bueller's Day Off was all in Cameron's head. What if it's literally just being made up from his perspective only. I thought that was kind of an interesting idea. And then, of course, number three is that the little brother dies in Radio Flyer. This is what I actually thought was the ending of the movie, but apparently this is merely a theory. I guess you can go back and figure that out for yourself. Number two is that a shitload of films end in the hero's head. Movies like Total Recall, or Taxi Driver, or Minority Report, or Observe and Report. All of these movies have plots and antagonists that, throughout the course of the movie, have solid resolutions to the things that occur to them in their respective movies, but could be explained away as only existing in their minds. Check those out, tell us what you think if you want, and last but not least, Chewbacca and R2-D2 are secret rebel agents. And the whole idea behind this is that that was the only way that they could think to make it plausible that R2-D2 and Chewbacca would reasonably have been in the prequels. And if so, that actually makes George Lucas clever and not desperate.
Oh, okay.
So there you go.
Something tells me I don't think that's the case, but...
I agree. But I thought it was kind of fun. And that is my last piece, and I think also the end of the news.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, then I guess we'll have stuff that we can carry over into next week. For now, I believe it is time for... Three Squared! Yes, folks. All right, so to commemorate the passing of the amazing Harold Ramis, we are going to be covering our three favorite Harold Ramis films. Now, we didn't put any limitation on if he acted in it, wrote in it, directed it, produced it, any combination thereof. Totally fine. We went with it. And do you want to go first, Tim, or do you want me to go first?
You can go first.
All right. Well, I'm going to do these not in order of my favorite to least favorite or anything. Not even necessarily in chronological order, but in the order in which I discovered them. First up for me, the seminal Ghostbusters. Of course, the 1984 American comedy, supernatural comedy film, directed by Ivan Reitman, written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, and then, of course, stars Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver, Harold Ramis, Rick Moranis, and in one of the earlier roles, Ernie Hudson and Annie Potts as well. Now, everybody knows what this movie's about. Everybody's seen it. But I just want to... This was the movie that introduced me to Harold Ramis. And I'm sorry, is there nothing cleverer in the writing? Cleverer? More clever? Whatever. In the writing than...
Heat them up. Do re
mi gong. That is just super cool. I loved it. It was so neat to actually see someone who was completely unashamed of being a nerd. Didn't even think of it as something that could be considered a detriment. And so committed to his science, and yet still was able to kind of be a badass. I mean, you know, he's got a proton pack and a nuclear reactor strapped to his back and everything. And it just made that character so good. Not to mention, and I didn't know it at the time, I was seven, that he also wrote it. And it just goes to show the creative genius that was there for Harold Ramis. And of course, nothing to take away from Dan Aykroyd. Clearly, he was just as involved. But man, it was cinematic magic. Cinematic magic, I say. And then next, of course, is the 1981 comedy film, Stripes. Now, notice, again, not in chronological order, because I was quite a bit older by the time I got around to seeing this movie on Skinamax or HBO or whatever it was. Had to have been easily 14, 15. And I saw it because it said R and R for nudity or whatever. So I was like, oh, I'm sitting down and watching this. I mean, I was, 14, 15 years old. Of course I'm going to sit down and watch boobies on Skinamax. Of course I am. And I sat down, and this is a movie that stars Bill, again, directed by Ivan Reitman, and also Harold Ramis was one of the writers of this movie, but it stars Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, and John Candy has some other cameos from other people like Dave Thomas, Bill Paxton, what have you. And this, of course, is the movie about two bums who go into the Navy mainly because they really don't have anything better to do, and they wouldn't have to worry about having to pay for stuff. mainly things like rent. And they go, they get in there, and then, of course, shenanigans ensue. I mean, you could think of this as the precursor to Private Benjamin, for those movies when we covered from Eileen Brennan. It's just a fantastic movie. Lots of fun. Yes, there's lots of stupid hijinks and everything. They got boobies and stuff. But it actually ends really, really well. I thought it was a fantastic way to completely turn things around and have some fun with the after effects of basic training and just watching people as they completely throw things together and wing it, and yet it turns out fabulous. It literally made me want to grow up and be like Bill Murray. And that's just something I think almost everybody should aspire to anyway. Not to take away from the fact that this is a Harold Ramis 3-squared, but let's face it, I just was, you know, influenced in that way. Harold Ramis, however, still fantastic.
Good morning. This is Basic English. My name is Russell Ziske, and I'm going to be your instructor for the next 5 weeks. So I want you to call me Russell, and I'm going to call you by your first names, because frankly, I'd have a pretty tough time pronouncing some of your last names. Okay, I know you're anxious to jump right in and start speaking English, but there are just a couple of things I need to know first, because I've never done this before. So, how many of you would say you speak English fairly well, but with some difficulty? A little English? Yes, you speak some English.
Son of bitch, shit.
Son of bitch, shit.
Last but not least for me is 1999's gangster comedy, Analyze This, that stars, it's directed by Harold Ramis and stars Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal as a mafioso man who goes to see a shrink. And, of course, respectively, we can figure out who's playing who there. This is just one of those times where the writing came in exactly right. This was from a story by Kenneth Lonergan and Peter Tolan. However, the screenplay was written by them and additionally with Harold Ramis. And this is just an amazing story. And what is so good about this is how Harold Ramis is able to coax the characters from the actors. That's not just good acting. These are all fantastic. I mean, just great actors and everything. But it's the way that he's able to get these people to coax the characters from them and have true character interaction on screen. When you see how these people behave and to some degree parody themselves in previous roles that they have played, that's good direction. That's good storytelling. And again, definitely a credit to the actors. I'm not trying to take anything away from them there. But that's one of the beauties of Harold Ramis. And you're going to hear more about that from Tim's perspective as well when he covers his movies. Just an amazing person who did some really cool stuff in writing and directing and acting as well.
My name is Ben Sobolione. Ben Sobolione. I'm also known as Benny the Groin, Sammy the Schnoz, Elmer the Fudd, Tubby the Tuba, and once as Miss Phyllis Levine. But that was at a party, it was years ago. I smoked at the Tupet, and I had a Quacalude, and then suddenly I'm in fishnets and singing show tunes. These things happen, but it has nothing to do with what I'm here with you fine gentlemen today. So I apologize. That being said, I'm also known to the people who know me the best as the fucking doctor.
So my movies again, 1984's Ghostbusters, 1984's Stripes, and then Analyze This from 1999.
Alrighty, so Harold Ramis. Now, before I begin my 3 squared, a lot of you are probably wondering, oh, hey, you know, where's Caddyshack? Where's National Lampoon's Vacation? Where's Meatballs, which he wrote? Club Paradise, Multiplicity, Year One, I guess, even for, unfortunately, some people now, who actually, I heard one person reference that movie to being a classic comedy. Why are they breathing? I don't know. Those are all, minus Year One, classic Harold Ramis movies. I mean, they're known for starring Bill Murray and Chevy Chase, a wide variety of folk, and they're classics, yet we have talked about them so much, I felt that there were other movies that we can bring upon and discuss and talk about, and hopefully, you know, maybe you haven't seen them, and or maybe you didn't even realize that they were Harold Ramis movies, which kind of makes him a very interesting figure of Hollywood and entertainment, just in the film community, because he's worked on a lot of classic films. I mean, like I said, Vacation, you know, Matt Stripes and Ghostbusters, Analyze This, a lot of these movies that are very different in concept, but they all share the same kind of, you know, storytelling in a way. Especially like with Analyze This, even with a later film of his, The Ice Harvest, just a lot of these movies are about just regular guys going through just kind of like the regular motions of life and experiencing, though they are, to an extent, very comical and very slapstick. But, I mean, they're just very kind of like relatable in many ways, and that's why we have a lot of these quotes. You know, you have the theme park for, you know, like Vacation, going to Wally World, and he helped create, you know, what people inspired to be comedic writers or filmmakers is because of a lot of his movies that he came out with in the late 70s, early 80s, including the work that he did on such TV shows. Well, especially, well, the one TV show he's really known for is SCTV. He worked on that. I mean, that's why he, you know, he knows Rick Moranis and just all those guys. So that's enough for an introduction of sorts. The first movie that I chose, I'm just going to go, I guess, chronologically. The first one is Groundhog Day from 1993. Yes, we've talked about it before, but I think this movie is definitely one that must be mentioned again. Matt talked about this one not too long ago, and this is the movie with Bill Murray and Andy McDowell, and Chris Elliott is the cameraman. It's about a disgruntled, egotistical weatherman in Pittsburgh who every year he covers just the Groundhog Festival. I forget what it's called exactly. It's the Groundhog Day event.
Punxsutawney Phil.
Yes, there you go. Punxsutawney and the Phil, the groundhog, and all that stuff.
This is pitiful. 1,000 people freezing their butts off waiting to worship a rat. What a hype. Groundhog Day used to mean something in this town. They used to pull the hog out and they used to eat it. You're hypocrites, all of you. You got a problem with what I'm saying, Larry? Untie your tongue and you come out here and talk, huh? Am I upsetting you, princess? You know, you want a prediction about the weather. You're asking the wrong Phil. I'll give you a winter prediction. It's going to be cold. It's going to be gray. And it's going to last you for the rest of your life.
While he is covering this event, and when he goes to sleep, he wakes up and he begins experiencing the same day over and over and over again. And he gets annoyed, he gets frustrated, he gets pissed off. But this movie does have a lot more depth than I think it really lets on to within the first, you know, 20 minutes or so. Why do I think it's a great movie? Harold Ramis directs it. He also worked on the screenplay. But the movie is very entertaining. It has a flow that seems completely effortless. And it has this groove that it falls into almost immediately. Like whenever, how you know that it's the next day, it's a new repeat of a day, is the camera shot of the alarm clock going off. It's not an alarm that goes off, it's the Sonny and Cher song, I Got You Babe, that plays. And just for some reason, there's more to this movie than I think what meets the eye. There are even, not necessarily classes, but in movie history, there are lessons and lectures devoted towards this movie, that there is a big metaphor to it. There's deeper meaning meaning within this movie. And I think that's what makes this a classic. This is one of Roger Ebert's favorite movies because of this movie is not only funny, but it's sweet, it's touching, it's engaging. It's just not another Bill Murray movie where he plays an asshole and, you know, like, finds love at the end of it, finds a girlfriend just so he can screw her and she's like a supermodel. No, I mean, he learns how to, he grows completely. He learns how to treat a woman. And yes, he gets pissed off and annoyed. But by like the fourth or fifth or sixth, the first week of time that, you know, that he's having to repeat the same day, he decides to do good for himself. He decides to, well, at first, being selfish about taking advantage of certain situations. He learns to become a better person. And therefore, he finds love with the Andy McDowell character. And yeah, and the movie just goes on. I mean, I'm assuming that a number of you guys that are listening, guys or gals that are listening, have seen the movie. If you haven't, that's all I'll say. Just, you gotta check it out. The next movie is from 2002, and it's Bedazzled. Yes, the Elizabeth Hurley and Brandon Fraser movie. Actually, you kind of forget that Brandon Fraser is even in it because Elizabeth Hurley is in that movie, if you know what I mean. It's from 2002, and it is actually a remake of the classic 1967 Dudley Moore and Peter Cook film of the same name. And this is the movie where Brandon Fraser plays the dweeby, geeky, unluckiest Elliot Richards, who is a technical support. He works as in technical support, I guess. And he gets courted by the devil, played by Elizabeth Hurley, and she wants his soul, so she says, well, I'll give you three wishes, and you have these wishes, and...
You know, I'll take your soul if, you know, by the end of it. You know, that's all. You know, it's the deal with the devil story.
And this movie is quite funny. It's not a solid movie. It's not a great movie whatsoever. But what really makes this movie entertaining and enjoyable is that it's separated with each wish. There are various, I guess, what you would call set pieces. And within these set pieces, the various characters that he plays, for example, when he ends up making that one wish where he turns out to be the Cuban mob boss, the Cuban crime lord or drug dealer or whatever, it is hilarious because he has the accent and he starts speaking in Spanish and he makes a comment about, oh yeah, you know, if my Spanish professor from seventh grade heard me now, I mean, she would be ecstatic, she would be filled with joy, but yet it's all in, like, if you're translating a Spanish soap opera, you know, it's like the very precise wordage, you know, there's no American slang or anything like that. So it just, I mean, just those little bitty bits that are thrown into the movie make the movie well worthwhile to watch.
Thank you, Jerry and Dan. Elliot, you must be one very proud young man this evening. Simply put, that was a staggeringly dramatic display of athletic ability.
Well, you know, you go out there and you give 110% and you want to play good and, you know, you hope you play good. I think we play pretty good tonight.
Well, in the lexicon of sports terminology, and I don't mean to sound contrary here, the word good falls tragically short of encompassing the sheer virtuosity of your performance this evening.
Well, you know, there's no I in the word team, and this is a team effort, and I just want to say that I'm really proud to be associated with these fine individuals that I have the pleasure of working with.
Now, I would never want to diss your teammates in any way, shape, or form, but you do realize that you smashed to bits Will Chamberlain's heretofore unbreakable record of 100 points in a single basketball game set in Hershey, Pennsylvania all those years ago.
Oh, man, you know, you just got to play one game at a time and go out there and give 110%, and you just got to show that you want it more than they do when chips fall where they may.
Thank you very much. Back to you, Jerry and Dan.
All right! Diablos! Number one! Yeah!
Again, it's a funny flick. There are many, many, many witty moments. Though the movie does become sort of stale, it's unable to top the previous gags. It starts off strong, but by the end of it, you just kind of want it to be over. But Harold Ramis wrote the screenplay. He directed the movie. And again, it showcases wit, his style, his ability to capture various attributes and aspects of a normal guy. Or even a normal interaction with the guy, and it's just, it's great, it's funny, it's, you know, it's something that you can look back on and smile, despite its, I guess, annoyances or problems. The next one is from 2002. It is entitled Orange County. It's not written or directed by Harold Ramis. It's actually written by Mike White and directed by Jake Kasdan, Mike White wrote School of Rock. He's done a number of things. Very witty writer. But he plays the dean of Stanford University. And the movie, for those of you who don't know, stars Colin Hanks and Jack Black. Colin Hanks' character is a teenager in Southern California, Orange County. He finds a book on a beach. And the book, you know, he's just inspired by it. And the book is written by Marcus Skinner, played by Kevin Kline, who teaches at Stanford. So Sean, played by Colin Hanks, has aspirations of going to school at Stanford and being the muse, studying under this Marcus Skinner, this great writer, and pretty much teams up with his friend, played by Jack Black. Hijinks ensue, one thing after another happens, and eventually the film leads to them going to Stanford, and Colin Hanks has an encounter with Harold Ramis, who does play the dean, and it is funny. Harold Ramis, how he speaks, you know, he can talk like this, you know, he can move his head, he can make these hand gestures. He just does it so perfectly for whatever character, and he's just able to convey so much comedy and so much wit just by an eyebrow raise, just by leaning towards a character. And in the scene, he's tripping out. He took drugs, and he's... It's just really, really funny.
Which ones were they?
Excedrin?
Excedrin. Okay, Excedrin are pain pills.
Pain pills?
No! Oh, my God!
What?
We just gave the Dean of Admissions three hits of...
Where were we?
Well, Mr. Durkett, to me, Stanford's not just a school, it's my entire reason for living. Every night before I went to bed, I'd pray that I'd get into Stanford. And I worked really hard. And when all my friends were out having fun, I stayed in and I studied.
That's good. That's what you have to do. 82%. Wait a second. I like you. What's your name?
Sean.
Sean? Sean, I like you. I do. I don't know why. I just like you.
Thanks.
I feel so good. Is it me, or is it, like, hotter than hell in here?
Hey, can you help me?
Yeah. Yes, I can. No, there's no time. I'm leaving. Going to Bali with my family. I love them so much. I need water, or I need to lie down.
Hey, before you do that,
Sean, you're my same height. That is neat.
Yeah, it is. Hey, listen, let's go to your office, and you can add my name to the acceptance list before you leave for Bali.
Sounds good, yeah.
And other than the movies that I mentioned before and then what Matt mentioned earlier, I do really think that these really showcase his talent. And it kind of makes it even more so sad that we lost such a filmmaker and writer within the Hollywood community. Again, my three movies were Groundhog Day from 93, Orange County from 2002, and Bedazzled from 2002 as well.
Right on. Okay, well, next week we're going to resurrect a long-lost segment from last year, and it's going to be called Did It Age Well? And the movie we are going to be finding out of whether or not it aged well is Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. That's right, folks. Now, we try to keep these movies at 20 years old or older, and guess what? Ace Ventura came out on February 4th, 1994. So we just barely made it in on this one. Barely made it in. It's 20 years old this year. We're going to see if it's aged well. This was a movie that, at the time, had a budget of $15 million and then had a box office of $107 million and launched Jim Carrey into superstardom. So that's what we're going to be doing next week. I guess we have nothing left then but the movies. the movies. So we've got Men of Tai Chi, Scenic Route, and The Queen of Versailles. What do you want to start with, sir?
Let's go with The Queen of Versailles.
Sounds like a plan. Okay, Queen of Versailles is a 2012 American documentary film by Lauren Greenfield, and it depicts Jackie and David Siegel. David Siegel is the owner of Westgate Resorts, which at the time of the filming, at the beginning of filming, was the largest timeshare resort business in the world. And they had actually just opened up, because it starts in 2007, 2008. I want to say it's about early 2008. And it starts just after they'd opened the Planet Hollywood Westgate Resort in Las Vegas, and is covering this family as they build their own version of Versailles. But then, as they're filming the documentary, the crash happens. The Great Recession, as we have come to call it.
My name is David Siegel.
My name is Jackman Siegel.
I am the founder, CEO of the largest timeshare company in the world.
I'm a 43-year-old mother of eight.
I thought she was the most beautiful girl in the world.
It took me a while to fall in love with him.
We have a great relationship.
There's 30 years between us, but he doesn't need Viagra. At least there is that option if he does, like, I don't know, if 10 years from now.
We never sought out to build the biggest house in America. It just kind of happened.
It's bigger than the White House.
2 tennis courts.
30 bathrooms.
Full-size baseball field.
10 kitchens.
Antique furniture.
90,000 square feet.
Oh, my God.
No, that's not my room. That's my closet.
No way.
Nothing's really normal about this life.
We're in line to do $1 billion in sales for the year. We're on top of the world. And it came to a screeching halt.
The market fell over 700 points.
I would say it's touch and go right now.
We don't talk about financial problems. I guess I'll have to watch the movie to find out what's going on in my life.
When everything changes.
This is almost like a riches to rags story. She knows we need to cut back, but she's still compulsive.
What time is it now?
Well, if I could afford a watch, I would tell you. Bankers are like vultures.
Our big problem is Vegas.
Our lenders have made it very clear that he'll have more money than he knows what to do with. He can go back to building his house if he turns over this building.
Over my dead body.
You can buy the palace that timeshare mogul David Siegel already wants to sell.
Just think of the bright side. You might not have to clean this house.
The American dream is raising way up above what you started with, and that is what she has done.
When you're down is when you find out who your true friends are.
You get strength from your marriage?
No.
I'm in this fantasy world, you know, until reality hits.
And so now they have to deal with the fallout. And so can they maintain their lifestyle? Can they keep the house? Can they even survive as they start losing their fortune? And they're literally losing everything. But it is kind of a true statement that even the rich don't go broke like we do, as is very evidenced by the film. I gotta say, though, that while they do a good job of showing just exactly how out of touch and in their own world they can be as the ultra-rich, especially for Jackie Siegel, they are not vapid. These are people who really do have, like for David Siegel, he really does have a business edge. He really does spend virtually every waking moment working, and even when he's home, he's working. And it's kind of sad, because in that regard, it doesn't seem like he has time for his kids that are there. But then Jackie is not some trophy wife, and is not some bimbo who just married an older man so that she could have his money. She's actually college educated. She was an engineer before she got into being a Mrs. Florida in that beauty pageant circuit and everything, and eventually got married here. She loves her kids. She really does care about people and trying to help those that she can. And it was really cool to watch. I thought that this was a really interesting story of what happens as an object lesson in rich people actually losing money and watching their dreams suffer, such as they are, and such as the suffering is. I really, truly enjoyed this movie. It is not by a perfect movie by any stretch of imagination, but definitely the story itself, the way it's told, the fact that you really do get a true window into these people's lives, and you can see just exactly how much like you and me they are, even at that level, for me, elicits 4 out of 5 stars on this movie. I really and truly was impressed, and while it does definitely have its drawbacks, I still liked it and would definitely recommend it. 4 stars for me. What about you, Tim?
It was a very interesting movie. So some of the people are completely oblivious to their overly, I guess, like, materialistic sensibilities. It's just kind of amazing. I really like seeing how, especially Jackie, the wife, I mean, she comes across as normal. She tries to do good. She does the whole charity thing. She does, yes, she had a college degree in engineering. She was an engineer. But still, she's overly, like, materialistic. And I just, after a while, it kind of got a little annoying because you'd see them... You see the setup of the movie, and you're like, okay, it's like I'm watching Real Housewives. But then you realize, oh, wait, you know, there is something more to these people, that they're a little more, not necessarily relatable, but to us, they seem more human. I mean, they're not just, she's not just a rich bimbo. I mean, she's smart, she's well-educated, and all that jazz. But then, as the movie goes on, you do see how, I don't want to say selfish, but they very well know that they're losing a lot of money, but yet she is still wanting to buy all these freaking board games for the family and drop in so much cash on these Christmas gifts. And again, you know, I totally understand that she's doing it because she wants to make everybody happy. She loves her family. And I totally understand that, but I don't know. I just think that I just have a hard time being able to accept that as in, like, okay, well, you know, I should feel bad for you because you're losing your husband's losing his empire, therefore you guys are going to have to downgrade to a smaller house. You know, he's not going to lose the entire company. And then, like, another thing is that I completely lost faith in these people. I lost any sense of, like, connection with them. You know, I stopped caring for these people. Once Jackie, the wife, says that they won't lose everything, there will be plenty of money to live by if or when, I guess it's just when, things actually fall through. And at the same time, you know, they're freaking out, like, oh God, we're going to be poor. We're going to be so poor. We're going to be living in this house. Like, oh, I guess I can put up with living in a, what did she say, a 2,700 square foot house or a 4,000 square foot house or... Just something to that nature, just like the size of a normal house. And she's saying that she can put up with that. Like, oh, you know, I'm not going to leave my husband because of this. I'm still going to be there and support him and support my 7 or 8 kids and be there for them. At that point, I just completely lost touch with these people, completely. And again, you know, there's still the yes, she's nice. But still, it's just like that, there's that connection that's missed that I missed, I guess. I don't know. But so I give this movie 3.5 out of 5. It's still entertaining, and I did enjoy it. It's just by maybe 1 hour and 10 minutes or 1 hour and 15 minutes, I was ready for this movie to be over with.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. What'd you say? 2.5 stars?
3.5.
3.5 stars. Okay,
yeah, 3.5.
Sweet. So where do you want to go to from here then, sir? We've got Men of Tai Chi and Scenic Route.
Let's go with Scenic Route.
All right, Scenic Route, 2013 American psychological thriller, which was directed by the brothers Goetz, Kevin and Michael, starring Josh Duhamel and, Duhamel? I don't know. And Dan Fogler, and literally just those two. This is two guys who... are friends that apparently went on a road trip. They go to take a scenic route and end up stranded in the desert.
Remember the last time we drove cross country?
Of course, it was just exciting. What's going on?
I think he just died.
What you got?
I got no service.
I'm gonna go up here and see if I can get a signal.
Nothing.
Here we go. Hold on! Hey!
Car trouble?
Wait!
The truck is not broken.
What do you mean it's not broken?
I took a wire out. I thought it would give us a chance to catch up.
Thank you for stopping.
You staged a breakdown in the middle of the desert so that we can talk? Are you insane?
We'll get you home. Get you back to your perfect little life.
Hot enough for you?
You sure you don't want to apologize for getting us stuck? Not freezing to death because you insulted my wife.
I'm sorry about the whole thing.
Every couple of months, I'll wake up freaked out that my life is meaningless. You know what I always wanted? Mohawk.
Do you love it?
I can't say nothing happened on this trip.
God, we were here all day and all night last night.
What
are you doing?
Come in!
You have to be out of your mind.
I don't know if this will really change anything, but I'm sorry.
It's definitely not your brightest idea.
Really interesting scenario. Now, I really, really, really did not want to see this movie going into it. Because the last Josh Duhamel movie I had seen was Fire with Fire. And it was such a terrible job by him that I had no faith in him anymore. I was like, wow, I was so excited when I first saw him in Transformers and everything. And I was like, hey, this guy could probably be pretty cool and everything. And then I saw Fire with Fire, and I was like, oh, dear God, please, no more. And then I saw this, and I was impressed. I couldn't believe it. They had a really cool way to make these characters simple yet believable. And I really felt that they were two friends who were having it out and really trying to get over the idiosyncrasies that have entered into their lives, that have brought them to the fore in the bane of mediocrity that has become to plague their existence. One is a guy who had dreams of doing it all and being a rock and roller and has settled down to become a family man in a seemingly unhappy marriage. The other is a guy who swore to never settle down and only ever follow his dreams, only to never have his dream realized, and is ostensibly homeless, living out of his truck. The character study was really cool. The only problem that I found with this movie was some of the outlandishness of the things that happen. They get into a fight about a third of the way into the movie. Of course, the movie opens with the aftermath of the fight, but then they lead up to it, and you get to it about a third of the way into the movie. And it really is just so over the top that I think it's just trying to prep you for the rest of the movie and how things are going to progress for them. I like the story overall. The execution was pretty darn good by the end of it, but the trope that is the psychological thriller doesn't really bear out in this film, especially by the ending, which might surprise some, but if you're paying attention, won't. And yet, was still oddly satisfying for me. I'm going to give this movie 3.5 out of 5. I did like this movie. I did find myself really enjoying it. But there are still some flaws that I think hold it back from being a really great movie. I think that if you are someone who likes character study, I think you'll really enjoy this film. If you're in it just because of the name recognition of Josh Duhamel, stay away. And if you just want to check out an interesting flick, check it out.
Yeah, this one surprised me as well. I thought it was a very nice contribution to the survival in plain sight type of films, because, I mean, their car breaks down on the side of a road. It's not like they're in the middle of the desert, as in between, like, sand dunes and shit, and in sand the entire time. No, they're just, when they say they're off the beaten path, they're just, like, on, you know, I guess what people would consider, I guess, maybe, like, Route 66 now, but more of the deserty Route 66. So it was pretty interesting. I mean, I can definitely see how maybe younger people, younger maybe teenagers or whatever, would watch this, and maybe second guess whenever they take that road trip cross country through the desert, maybe take a sturdier car which I think would be maybe the smartest thing to do regardless. I really like the character escalation, or the characters in like the escalation of events, I should say. That's the word, events. Because the movie ends, I mean, you know this by, I'm sure whoever reads the synopsis of the movie, know that the friendship crumbles into something that is quite brutal, but even knowing that, it doesn't ruin anything about the movie, because you don't know why, you don't know exactly what happens, you don't know what happens after it, you don't know if it comes at the end of the movie, in the middle of the movie, at the beginning of the movie, you just really don't know, and that's what I really appreciated about this movie. It was simple. It's a low-budget movie, but it looked beautiful. I love the cinematography. I got the feeling that they were stuck completely. I mean, like, that's what I said. It's stuck in plain sight, or survival in plain sight. I felt that there was absolutely no opportunities lost in this movie. They took the genre, if it is a genre, and created something that I felt was fresh and new. And on top of that, they have these spectacular performances, excellent performances. And I just, especially Dan Fogler, when I first heard about the movie, before I watched any clips, I wasn't sure, because I'm used to seeing Dan Fogler in goofy, comedic, slapstick, very hokey, corny roles. Not the best goofy friend who can really get pissed off and very serious when he needs to be. And I appreciate that. I don't want to say career-defining role, but I think in some way it was, you know, a career-defining role, especially if he hasn't done anything like that on screen ever, which I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure, I mean, this is the case. Very powerful, I'll even say. I thought the ending was forced, and I felt like it belonged in a different movie. I'm not going to give away what happens at the end. I guess there's maybe two twist endings in some way. Again, it just felt forced and a little too obvious, and again, out of place. But other than that, I thought it was a very solid, well-made movie. Beautiful direction, it had gorgeous setting, great cinematography, and though it was low budget, it feels like a bigger budget movie. I give this one 4 out of 5. I'm really glad we watched this. A surprise.
Right on. Okay, well then I guess that's going to leave us with Man of Tai Chi. How exciting is that, right?
What? Or, according to Keanu Reeves,
yeah. Mm-hmm. It's probably the quote of the movie right there. So did that make any sense to you at all? Well, in that movie?
He was conveying that he was upset that the guy lost the Tai Chi match.
I guess so. Okay, Man of Tai Chi. This is the 2013 Chinese-American martial arts film, and it was the directorial debut of Keanu Reeves. Stars Keanu Reeves, and then the rest of the cast is Asian, Chen Pyu, Karen Mok, and Simon Yam. It's a really interesting movie about a young man who is by the name of Tiger Chen, who is the sole pupil of an elderly Tai Chi master. He has a life that's he's kind of struggling single guy with a prospective girlfriend, and he's got parents that he tries to take care of, and really all he has in his life is just the beauty of Tai Chi, and he wants to share that with the world and show that Tai Chi isn't just something that you take for a PE credit at community college. It's more than what David Carradine did with it in the television show Kung Fu. And he is discovered, because he goes into a fighting competition, he is discovered by a security magnate played by Keanu Reeves. And this guy is not a nice guy, he's not a good guy, and he wants to take Tiger Chen and make him into the ultimate fighter. And of course it's all underground fighting and everything, but whatever, it pays well, and you kind of see this descent into the dark side. It's kind of like watching Anakin Skywalker, if you will, be seduced by the Emperor into a trip down to the dark side. Now, that being said, this movie is competent, I think is the right word. I think that Keanu Reeves did a solid standard executable. You know, if you look on the list of decent movie, then he achieved that. The one thing that I was disappointed in was the level of wire work. It starts off with virtually none, and by the end of it is way too much. And I was just, yeah, it's just kind of like, I really wish that they could do faster moves and be creative and be inventive without having to use the wireworks. The very first fight that you see was painfully slow in the choreography, and you could kind of see some of the flaws in it, but then as you see the Tai Chi being introduced into it, it gets better, and they do a better job of speeding it up, and as it gets faster, it starts looking better, and of course you're seeing that. I have to say that overall, as a directorial debut, this is a very competent piece of work by Keanu Reeves. I think that for the next time he wants to do something of this nature, he should stay behind the camera. And yet, despite that, this is just an okay movie. The fight choreography is pretty decent. The directing is pretty decent. He definitely had some good cinematography going on, so Elliot Davis deserves credit for that. But it's just, it lacked heavily in the acting department. Really and truly did. And especially on the part of Keanu Reeves. It just was, I don't want to say borderline laughable, but it was pretty bad. With the exception of, which to me was laughable. Again, I just... the acting really didn't do it for me. So I'm going to go ahead and say 2.5 out of 5. If you don't have anything better to do, check it out. It's just okay.
This is a 3 out of 5 for me. Liked it just maybe a skosh more than you. The fight scenes and choreography start off quite impressive, but then they become just another fight scene as the movie wears on. It becomes tiresome and too surreal long before the final overly surreal fight sequence between Tiger Chin and Master Keanu. I say surreal because it's weird. It's like you can tell that Keanu took I guess aspects or some pointers from a lot of the kung fu or the martial arts movies from Asia from the early late 70s and the 80s, where they're very stylized. That's kind of like the villain, you know, he's always angry, he's always, you know, everything concludes with death. The villain always dies by morals, I think, in some way. Like, morals always, karma comes back and always bites him in the ass, and it's always, like, the most obvious thing, really, in the end of the movie is the death of the bad guy. And this movie is definitely, I guess you could say it succeeds and falls flat because it tries too much to be like that without it being more so of its own bag, baby. Again, I like the surrealism of the movie and the stylization, very retro, but there's only so much that the retro stylization and the over-the-top Tai Chi, Kung Fu, you know, martial arts, there's only so much that can carry the film. That's only so long that it can carry the film for before, you know, you get overworked and tiresome by it. It's not like a fight scene within a chase scene, you know? It's a fight scene within a big fight scene. And then, like, 5 minutes later, there's another fight scene. And, you know, yeah, I mean, that kind of sounds awesome. And a lot of these, and I think if you view each fight scene separately, especially those close to the end, you might think, oh, wow, that's awesome. Oh, wow, that's beautiful. Oh, wow, I love how they did this and do that. But it just becomes kind of like, they're trying too hard to make each one significantly different that it just takes away from the experience. Like, they're trying too hard to go out of their way to create another awesome sequence to top the other sequence that you just saw, you know, 10 minutes ago. Keanu Reeves, I thought, played a decent villain, and I thought this was a decent, a good directorial debut for him. And I thought the actor who played Tiger Chin did a very good job on carrying, you know, the movie and acting and making the change from the good guy to the bad guy character, or more of a badder guy throughout the movie, because his character is becoming more influenced by violence and all this stuff and fueled by blood and fury and anger. But yet, that goes against the Tai Chi way of doing things and all that jazz. So the movie is interesting. It goes for the more violent mix with the, I don't know if it's like spiritual, the teachings of martial arts, the teachings of Tai Chi, in that good will overcome evil, the spirits of Tai Chi. You know, if you believe in them, you will then overcome death, and you will be overcome by fury and overcome by Keanu Reeves randomly screaming at you through a camera. But yeah, it was interesting enough to warrant the 3 out of 5 rating from me.
And I guess that brings us to the end of the movie. So for next week, we are going to be covering 300 Rise of an Empire, Mr. Peabody and Sherman, and Prince Avalanche, which is available on Netflix, yes?
Yes, that is correct.
All right, so 2 of them coming out in the theaters, and 1 of them for Netflix for next week. All right, well, I guess that's it. We're pretty much just down to the spiel, aren't we?
That is correct. Spiel on.
All right, well, as always, the music you've been listening to has been brought to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at reverbnation.com, myspace.com, and facebook.com/criesofsolace. As for us, well, of course, we're the SLS Cast, and you can check us out at slscast.com. You can also send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at theslscast. Go to Facebook, search for the SLS Cast there. And, of course, subscribe to us on iTunes or favorite us on Stitcher. So, that brings us to the end of the show. And until next time, this is Matt that's saying thanks to Kevin Kline. I get to say this. I think every American actor wants to be a movie star. But I never wanted to do stupid movies. I wanted to do films.
And this is Tommy Keezy saying, I'll catch you guys next week. Cheers.